Hi, my name is Tarek Waked, founding partner at Type 1 Ventures. You have joined us for Between Two Rounds, a conversationalist podcast that talks about everything from space, sci-fi, bringing interesting people to give you an insight into what our world looks like and where we see the world going. Today, we have Anton Brefti from IBX, Kem Ghaffarian's family office, who started Axiom Space, Quantum Space, X Energy, among others. And previously, he was at Prime Movers Lab. So coming from the VC world and seeing how the space industry is growing and shaping, join us for a little bit of banter and some good conversation around what we think the future looks like. Thank you. Hey, Anton. Good to see you today.
Hey, Tarek. Thanks for having me, man.
Appreciate it. Thanks for coming in. Where'd you fly in from today?
Austin? Yep.
Yeah, I really enjoy Austin. I think it's an up-and-coming tech city.
Yeah.
I've only been a couple times.
Yeah.
What do you recommend for Austin, for all those that are visiting?
Yeah, like a lot of cool spots. The thing that comes to mind, like Austin is booming, and I don't know what LA feels like. I spent a decade in San Francisco, and when I was there in San Francisco, it was the 2010s, it was a boom period. And it's just exciting being in a place that's growing and people are excited to be there. And Austin feels very much that way.
Do you think that's home for you in the long term?
I think so. I have a young family. It's like a great place for a young family. I kind of begrudgingly left San Francisco. Like it wasn't really, I felt like it wasn't on my terms. We were going to have kids. Like I didn't have some huge exit, so I wasn't going to, you know, ball out and buy a huge mansion in Mill Valley. And so we moved to Austin.
Good investment that you didn't buy it because it would have probably tanked.
That's true. But the more time I've spent there, the more I've like really come to love the city. And like Texas has such a unique personality.
Cool. Well, thank you for being here in LA today.
What do you think about LA?
I love LA. You know, I think we share this a lot because I wasn't born in the US and I didn't grow up in LA, but I came here after college and this is where I built my career in tech. And I really love it because there's not a lot of distractions for wanting to build your own type of lifestyle. So if you want to be healthy, you can be healthy. Yep. If you like hiking, you can find hiking. If you like snowboarding or going to state parks, you can do that. If you like tech, the space ecosystem is really built around LA. So for me, it's, I think it's home for the long term, but I've always had this idea of like, I want to check out Austin. I want to see it.
Yeah.
How locals see it.
Does it feel like it's on the up and up, like living here, like relative to when you first moved here, or has it just been consistent?
I think everyone thinks their city's on the up and up.
Yeah.
And it's just opinions, but I love it. I don't really concern myself.
San Francisco, like during COVID, right after COVID, I mean, it was kind of like a...
Yeah, it was a ghost town.
I had moved already out of
there. I lived in San Francisco during before COVID.
Pre-COVID.
Yeah. I moved to LA March or February 11th, and then lockdowns happened 2 days later. So yeah, I've always followed you from the first time I ever met you or heard of you. You were at Prime Movers Lab.
Yep.
And you posted a piece on why space is a bubble.
Yep.
And you literally shit on my life. all the things you were talking about that are maybe a bubble in the space ecosystem are the things that I've been very active investing in, like Space Forge and space stations and lunar infrastructure.
Yep.
And so I actually wrote a piece of like to counter you, but I never posted it. And it's really cool to see you here now and how involved you are with Axiom Space and IBX. Yeah. So maybe tell us a little bit about yourself, your trajectory getting into venture, your trajectory working in space. I think the audience would find it useful.
Cool. I'll do the short version as we were talking about earlier today. Immigrant, was born in Ukraine. We came to America when I was 4, grew up in Boston, went to school in Philly. My first kind of, not really a break, but just kind of like one of those fork in the road moments was I took a first job out of college in San Francisco. Everyone I knew, I studied finance, was going to New York, and it was...
What did you do right out of college?
Yeah, so it was an interesting company. It was a company that bought and sold used manufacturing equipment for semiconductor plants. It's a very weird niche. I thought it was a finance job because the title was capital asset trader. But it was just a total sales gig and like a boiler room, just dial in for dollars, a bunch of, you know, freshly graduated kids, you miss quota, you get fired, you do well.
Sell me this pen.
Yeah, that type of stuff. Unlimited commissions, walking out the door on Fridays with $500 in cash. Just a ridiculous place. And I didn't even know sales was a profession because in college, you know, you can't get a degree in sales, right? So they don't bother telling you about it. But, you know, I ended up doing really well, made a lot of money for a 21-year-old, paid off my student loans. And I met two guys there and we said, the way that company worked was very manual, just people, like literally humans calling each other.
What year was this?
This was 2011.
Okay. So still kind of relatively early and
yeah.
Things digitalizing. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
And in this sector, nothing. It was just no one knew about this. And the people who knew about it were not in position or equipped to change it.
To give everyone insight on 2011, at least for those Gen Zers out there, we were still posting on Instagram with stupid filters. And it was, if I look back now at like the state of tech 12, 13 years ago, and compare it to the state of tech today, it was like, well, the Wild West.
Yeah, early days.
Yeah.
And the cool thing about San Francisco, like my parents are small business owners. Like I've been around entrepreneurship, but like I wasn't gung-ho about it. But when you live in a place where people are like, everyone's starting a company and a lot of the ideas like don't sound that smart.
Exactly.
You're just, it makes it very approachable. And so me and these two guys that I'd become close with were like, why don't we start a startup? Why don't we try and digitize
this? How hard could it be?
Yeah. So naive. We all had the same skill sets. It's like we started a band with three drummers.
Abdo would love that.
he's a drummer fan.
Yeah, he's a drummer.
And yeah, so that was my first company. We got into YC, which was a big deal. And big deal for me. Like I've always, prior to that point, I always felt like an outsider. It wasn't until San Francisco and that I felt like I was around my people, and getting into YC was like my first like status badge where right. like I felt like I was like part of the club. But long story short, that startup took an interesting turn. It became profitable but stopped growing. So I would say like we failed because we didn't achieve what we wanted to, mm-hmm. but it still operates today. So I'm proud of that. But when that ended, I was trying to figure out what to do next. I never thought I would be a VC, but I reconnected with this guy, Dakin Sloss, who I met at Demo Day. And he was just getting a fund started called Prime Movers Lab. I joined, was his chief of staff, was there for 3 years. It was kind of a crazy time period. And over that 3 years, became a partner and started investing in space. So I'm a believer in space, but what I noticed during those years was a lot of the startups that were pitching me were selling to other startups, mm-hmm. and those startups were selling to other startups. And I realized like I'm a big believer in this long term, but in the very short term, this is a very fragile ecosystem and it could collapse quite quickly.
I didn't post my rebuttal to you because I originally took it very personally because I was like, oh, wow, those are all the things that I'm investing on. But you had really valid points.
Yeah.
And we see that a lot with companies that, well, this company needs to raise to then be able to to pay for this contract that they need in the future. So that's like double financing risk.
Yeah,
and I think that's what you were drawing attention to. And so, you know, that's the name of the game in an emerging industry like the private space sector.
The thing... I had a feeling you were going to bring it up. So I was thinking about it and like, you know, was I right? So the blog post was like 2023, the space tech bubble is going to blow up. So in some ways, I think it was somewhat accurate. Like the public space stocks have all more or less tanked and the funding dried up. But what I missed or was wrong about was like, there hasn't been like a whole bunch of bankruptcies. Like I totally underestimated how long companies can survive for if they need to, even though there's been way less money invested.
Sure.
You know, like those companies are still going. It's just,
has there been less money invested in the private space sector compared to those years?
Yes.
I'd love to see those figures if we could pull them up.
let's pull up the chart. I think so. I think there's like Space Capital has a funding report.
Okay.
Well, it went like crazy in 2021. Like, and especially if
2021
you include,
was an anomaly.
Yeah.
You know, we at Type One, we started in 2019
yeah.
And in 2021, we raised our first fund and our SPV at like demand was through the roof compared to previous years.
Yeah.
So definitely saw that.
Yeah. The quote, I think it's a Bill Gurley quote, or I don't know if it's a quote, but something he says, which really resonated with me is greed creeps in slowly. And so like you had this ZIR period, right? Like whatever, decade plus. And like the greed kept increasing and increase FOMO, people making money.
Yeah.
Meme stocks, crypto,
NFTs. In 2021, end of 2021, I bought this like NFT for like with Abdo and we bought it. I think it was like $10,000 convert to the Ethereum price. And in 2 months, it was worth like $150,000. And Abdo was asking me to sell it because we owned it together. And I was like, no, it's going to keep going up. It's worth like $5,000
today. Yeah. But, and so the final part of his statement is like greed grows slowly, but fear is instant. So like once things turn and like the psychology flips, it crashes quickly. And that's like the cyclical nature of venture, which I had read about. But this was the first cycle that I personally was like in it, like on the front lines. And it was the same thing. Like deals are hot. There's money flowing in. Investors want
You never access. See the tide coming up. But when it comes down, it comes down quickly.
Yeah. And I think the frustrating thing about it is like we both invest in very ambitious hardware.
Right.
I don't know if you guys if do software stuff, but a lot of it's like deeply technical.
We'll do some software stuff. We do a lot of stuff in AI.
True.
We're investors in OpenAI and Anthropic and some of these companies. We just did a, well, it's kind of hardware, but we did a large investment into the Grok Series D.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah. Congrats, that's Thank exciting. You. But yeah, the thing I was going to say is just that these companies can have such a huge impact on the world, and so many of them won't succeed, not because the technology doesn't work, or it's just because they won't be able to raise the money.
Right.
And it's sad that that's the limitation on like humans progressing.
But the best founders find a way to tell the story to attract the dollars that they need. And also when I see companies or founders that are so set in how much money they need to achieve a certain goal, that line of thinking will ultimately make that outcome where it's like, if I don't raise this money,
or it's a fair point.
You know, there's ways to get around that issue.
It's like necessity is the mother of innovation. Or
correct.
Whatever.
And a lot of people talk about how hardware is innovative or deep tech is, capital intensive.
Yep.
But how many software companies that are very cheap to build your initial MVP and get your first customers, but it's capital intensive to retain those customers because everyone else has a similar product. When it's hardware, it's capital intensive to build that first MVP, but once you've built it and you lock in a customer or two, those customers stay for a long time. So your cost of customer retention in deep tech, in hardware, is a lot less. So it's capital intensive up front, but it's not as capital intensive as a software company in the back end.
Totally, yeah. It has a defensible technology moat. And so your margin is defensible for a longer period of time. But that upfront, and then you have a market correction. But I agree with your point that like it's healthy for the ecosystem for it to be hard, and like the best founders will make it through.
And so you were at Prime Movers Lab, and then afterwards, now you're working at IBX with Cam Ghaffarian.
Yep.
With Axiom Space, X Energy, Quantum Space.
Yep.
He's got a portfolio of companies. Talk to me about your transition there from going to investing to now working with a prolific operator like Cam Ghaffarian.
Yeah, I think I like the framework of like, what are you moving towards? What are you moving away from? So the towards here is Cam. Like my model, well, take a step back. Like I'm a huge techno-optimist. I think technology is like the engine that moves humanity forward. I think founders are the ones that enable that technology to move forward. So I have a very founder-centric view of
Well, historically, it's always been, I don't think it's a thinking that founder, technology moves humanity forward. I think it's a proven fact.
For sure on that part. I think there's some people that think the market is more important. And actually, I think both can be right. Like you can make money like betting on the market and be like, there's going to be an opportunity here. And like, I'll make a series of bets. Mm-hmm. I just personally relate more to like founders, like being the change agents that actually create the value. And like my favorite part of being a VC, it's really like a very fun job in general. So intellectually stimulating, but meeting founders, and you get to screen so many, and then like, you know, I used to think I was like a good founder. Then you like, you meet these people, you realize like there's levels to this game.
Yeah.
And when you meet someone like Cam, or was on the board of a company founded by Greg Weiler, like you realize like these
space.
Like, yeah. Yeah. Nice. And OneWeb before that, like they're just on another level. And the opportunity, I got this opportunity to come alongside Cam at his family office and lead his venture activities, where he's incubated and scaled up a number of companies, is just too good to pass up on. And the thing I was moving away from, I think the worst part of VC is there's an arrogance that seeps in because you're in this position of power. People are coming to you asking you for money. You do this thought leadership, which is fine, which I did too. It's easy to start thinking that like you're the smart one.
Right.
And I don't think that's true. I think the founders are they're the ones that are actually making the future. And I think I love investing. I intend to do more investing, but I've never worked in the space industry. I am an avid science fiction reader and I'm intellectually curious, but I thought it was a good investment in my career to actually go and work with someone that's at the frontier of this sector, and I will be a much better investor. That's the theory, at least.
Yeah, and I think that's playing out. For me, I have a very similar perspective where I never worked in the space industry prior to starting Type One, but I saw an opportunity. Yeah. And it's not just the engineers who are going to make the space industry a success. It's the founders, it's the operators, it's the marketers. And so if we can bring an outside perspective to the space industry, the thesis is that we will be better investors.
Yep.
Because ultimately, what's the difference between a space company and a software company? It's just the sectors they play in. There's hard problems to solve on both ends, but it's still a business.
Yep.
It still has to scale. It still has to make money. It still has to be self-sustaining long-term.
Yep.
And for us, that was the original thesis when we started in 2019. But yeah, thank you for coming on the podcast. We call it Between Two Rounds.
Yep.
And it's just going to be a general open-ended conversation.
Awesome.
I think one thing that I've really honed into while being a VC and prior as a founder is getting to know people on a personal level, and the depth of which you makes you who you are and influences your thinking, your decision-making, your view of the world, and getting to know that, I think for anybody watching is really important for you and for Cam and for just the general space industry. And we can have conversations to change our thinking and influence our view of the world. And if we can make that available to everyone, I think that's really important.
Love it.
What is your view on the space industry moving forward? Obviously, you had a perspective that a lot of companies needed to raise money, which is true. There needs to be new investors and new money flow into the space industry. How do you think that's changed? Where do you think that's going to be 5, 10, 20 years from now? What's your long-term view on and where we're going?
Yeah, so I'm 35, and my decision to like double down on space, and this happened when I was at Prime Movers Lab. When I joined, it was a very small team. We were investing in a lot of different areas. We started scaling up the team, and I realized like, oh, we're gonna start specializing. Like, it makes sense to specialize. Like, you build out the ecosystem, you build out your knowledge, you can diligence things quickly. And we had done some space investing. Dakin did preceding me, and so I was always into space. Like, one of my earliest memories, but like I have this clear memory. I'm only child. My parents work during the day, so like I had a lot of time alone. I was in the library and I came across this book about black holes, and it just like totally blew my mind. There's like there's a word called spaghettification, at least in this book, which like I remember like five things from like before high school. This is one of them.
Spaghettification.
Yeah. Again, CJ can fact check me here. The way the book described it is like, as you get sucked into the black hole, you will get stretched out. Again, like, I don't know if any of this is true.
I mean, if you're getting close to a black hole,
a lot has gone wrong.
There's like time dilation. Yeah. You're probably dead by now because theoretically.
You're in a world of hurt. But
then they talk about how black holes could like be a portal to a white hole, which could then
Like, and that was in that book too.
Okay.
Yeah. Either way, I was like 12, and this book like blew my mind, and like, you know, Ender's Game. Like it's just always something.
I love Ender's Game.
I've been passionate about. I never thought I'd like professionally pursue space, but then, you know, lo and behold, there was this opportunity, and so I kind of like jumped on this on. Really, I started looking into it, and I'm sure like this, the audience will be familiar with this, but. You know, you look at the launch cost chart, like the launch cost chart was really what did it for me. And this is how much does it cost to send a kilogram to low Earth orbit? And it's, you know, whatever the numbers you want to look at.
I think at the ISS, it was when they built the ISS, it was either 40 or 80,000, depending on the year.
Yeah.
Per kilo.
Yeah. I think space shuttle is 45,000 is the number I saw.
And that's how they built the ISS.
Yep.
And now it's less than 1,000.
Yeah, I think, yeah, whatever. Yeah, it's something like 30 times cheaper, maybe more.
And it's
more.
Getting cheaper with Starship.
Yeah. And so, like, that was just like, you see a graph like that, it's just like, yeah, like, there's obviously something really interesting that's going to happen here.
How do I get involved?
Yeah. And for me, it was an investment, like a decades long investment. Mm-hmm. Like, I have a hard time trying to say, like, what's going to happen in the next couple of years. Like, I'll do my best effort, but what I was had a lot of conviction on is that like this is a good place to invest in for the decades to come. Do you have any gurus? I have two gurus. One is Naval. Like okay. I just love what Naval says. He has a quote that's play long-term games with long-term people. And so like there's so many benefits come from committing to doing something for a long period of time.
Right, right.
And I'm
especially nowadays when everyone wants like instant gratification for things.
Yeah.
Where it's like, play for 10, 20 years.
Yeah.
And if we're going to live a lot longer, which trajectory shows that we are going to live a lot longer, some people believe in the longevity escape velocity. So what if like we live to 120?
Yeah.
Is that's like a normal thing.
Yeah.
What's 10 years?
Yeah.
What's 15?
Totally.
And so I definitely agree with you. Sorry, I cut you off.
No, you're good. So yeah, it was that kind of like long-term concept that and the innate interest in it that was like just made me super excited to dig in. And, you know, I can nerd out on like the specific sectors that I'm excited about, but like fundamentally it's that it's just like this belief in what's going to happen in the future.
I always find people like Cam Ghaffarian or Gary Hudson.
Yep.
Some of these guys who were involved in the space industry in like the 80s and 90s and 2000s. Some of those guys were doing space companies before I was even alive.
Yeah.
Before you were even alive. And how seeing that industry, that's the epitome of like do something for the long term.
Yep.
And I can only imagine what the industry will be like when we're the age of those guys.
Yep.
And they look back at the industry today, like think about it. Let's see, could we be on Mars in 10, 15, whatever time period you believe? Are we going to have humans long-term settled on the moon?
Yep.
They're going to be space stations that have tens, if not hundreds of humans in them. And if the cost of launch is a lot cheaper, look at companies like Space Perspective, which I know you guys invested in during your time at Prime Movers, $125,000 for a ticket to space.
Right. Yep.
So what does that world look like? And what are the companies that are going to be started in that future?
Yep.
And they're going to look at us and say, wow, you guys were involved before any of this happened. And it's easy to come back and say, yeah, well, we believe this future would exist.
Yeah.
And we work towards it. I think it's like if the world is full of problems and issues, why not do something that's meaningful and worthwhile?
Yep.
And that's what I'm excited about.
Yeah. I also think there's an interesting, and I know you're into history as well, like an anthropological view of this, which is like it's inevitable. Like humans, like you just zoom out, look at the time lapse of humans. Like humans go out into as far as they can go.
Well, yes, I agree with you. Some people will take the view that humans are a virus, and some people will take a view that we shape the world to our liking and we make the world better for everything else.
Yeah.
Long term.
Yeah.
There's probably short term issues that people focus on, but I do agree with you.
Well, and even if you take away whether it's good or bad, like it just happens. So unless humans go away, like humans are going to go out.
Right.
Like if we have the capability, we'll do it. Like my favorite, or like something I was like really blown away from, I think it was in Sapiens when he talks about like, it took like so many thousands of years for people to leave Africa, Homo sapiens. And then these, you know, crazy tribes decided to go up to the Bering Strait, and there was the land bridge. But from
those were the founders of that day. That's they're right. Like, let's go there.
That's right. Like, what are they going for? But from the moment they got there, you know, Alaska basically, to it took them like a couple thousand years to get to Patagonia. Mm-hmm. Like, which is just insane. Like, what is driving that?
I've thought about this. So the human brain can keep. Have you ever noticed how as you get older, you lose touch with friends that you used to, you know, sure. hang out with, or as you get more focused on work, you maybe don't see your best friends for yep. 6 or 12 months. The human brain can manage 150. And I think it was in a Malcolm Gladwell book, 150 relationships.
Yeah. Dunbar number, I think it's called.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And once we have more than that, back in the day, there was villages and yep. there was 150 people because you know everybody in your yep. village. When there's 200 people, then the villages tend to split up into two.
Yeah.
And then you have the odd ones out or the ones that don't aren't part of that in group. And then they migrate a little bit further yep. for more food or more yep. resources and so on and so forth. So the yep. misfits have always been the ones that yep. push that frontier.
Yep. Yep.
And like, I hope in the future they can create like simulations that we can like experience what it could have been like living in medieval times or even back then.
Yeah.
Cause I think that would be fascinating and there'd be a lot of similarities with modern humans.
Yeah. The misfits thing reminds me of something I've been thinking about recently. So I think, you know, space is the final frontier, right? Like it's been described as a frontier. I think, frontiers are really important. Like I think you could point a lot of the issues we have today are because people have a zero sum view of the world, which you could kind of like boil down to like, is my life improving? Is my kid's life going to be better than my life? If you answer no to those questions, you're going to be in a bad mental state. And
right.
that's where like populism and conflict.
Right. Right.
And frontiers provide a lot of different opportunities. One of them is growth. And I think that's an important piece. One thing I was thinking about is, you know, if you look at the US as an example, right, like the Puritans came over because mm-hmm. they were being persecuted mm-hmm. in England. And mm-hmm. so they came here for those rights. Like, who are the people that are going to go settle the moon and Mars? Like, originally they'll be like,
you know, you're like scientists and like very like the guy who I read a book by Robert Zubrin, his newest book. It said, "What are we going to build on Mars?"
Yeah,
love that book. I consumed it in a day. But it's like the initial people will be because it's you need to have a guy that knows how to fix machinery, yeah. but also is a doctor.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then once those are like first yeah. self-sustaining colony gets there, you're going to have people that open up bars and yeah. yeah. So who are those people going to be?
And I think if that pattern holds where it's people that don't fit in or are being ostracized, now we're just getting into like sci-fi talk, but like the other wave that's coming is this AI wave. And is it going to be, you know, like is AGI going to be regulated on Earth? And so the people that want to pursue AGI have to go to the moon? Or is the Neuralink Elon's view of like becoming cyborgs, like integrating with AI is the only way that humans don't get destroyed by AGI, but people on Earth don't want that to happen. And so the cyborgs, you know, like, yeah. like who are the misfits that will decide, you know what, it's worth going to the moon because it's going to be hard. I mean, like we're excited about it, but it's going to be difficult. Just like the Puritans giving up their homes in England to go try and settle a brand new continent.
A lot of people will talk about why go yeah. to the moon or why go yeah. to Mars? If you look at, and Robert Zubrin in his book positioned this really well, the biggest export that a Mars colony or a lunar colony will have is exports of innovations and ideas.
Yep.
Because those people will be going to a frontier.
Yep.
And they will be some of the brightest people who are willing to take that yep. risk and leave everything behind.
Yeah.
Sure, you can come back every 2.2 years. But
yeah.
The innovations that will come from take everybody, put them in San Francisco, yep. smart people that are looking to break that frontier. And then look at all the startups that have come out of a place yep. like Silicon Valley. The same thing could and may happen
yep.
on another frontier like Mars. And that we're taking like a really long-term view here, yep. but to bring it back, I think.
Well, sorry, if I could just say one yeah. more point, like I don't think it's so far out. Cause like it's a pattern that repeats itself. Like, a lot of the success that America is credited for is because of its, like, the founding fathers and, like, all of these innovative political mm-hmm. concepts. Mm-hmm. You know, taking individual rights and separation of church and state and checks and balances. And like that served us really well for whatever, 250 plus years. But like as stuff gets older, like it calcifies and like we got entropy. All these issues now.
It's entropy.
Yeah. And newness and the ability to have a blank canvas is incredibly important. And like the next generation of political systems, I love America, immigrants love America, I love America, I want America to, you know, be the leading power for as long as it can. But like these things go up and down, they wane.
Yeah.
And there will be innovation, not just in technology, but in the way that humans live together.
100%.
We have been living
in a unipolar world for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
Before that, there was the Soviet Union and the US, it was bipolar.
Yeah.
And now we've had America as like the sole superpower for the last, since 1991.
Yeah.
Ever since I've been alive.
Yeah.
And the world is changing to multipolar.
Yeah.
And I think there needs to be, and maybe technology will be part of that.
Yeah.
Like think about why we feel the world is so bad now.
Yeah.
Because we have access to all the things that are happening, all the wars. Those wars and conflicts have been happening for millennia.
Yeah.
If you take a pulled out view of history, we're less poor than we've ever been before.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, there's less poverty.
Yeah.
People can get access to education just with a smartphone.
Yeah.
And maybe I'll get a lot of criticism on this, but I think we live in the most interesting time and the most abundant time ever.
Yeah,
and that will be new innovations and new forms of living will be born. And it's super exciting for us to be on this frontier. So I'm excited to see where the future goes.
Totally.
I'm optimistic about that. Okay, so to take a step back, you are now working with Cam on things like Axiom Space and Quantum Space. Where do you think the next 5 to 10 years for the space industry, what does it look like?
Okay.
Are we going to have space stations that, you know, tens if not hundreds of humans can go up? Or is it just going to be reserved for the private space agencies or very wealthy people?
Totally. Yeah, we can leave sci-fi land. Maybe
we can come back to it.
Yeah. Is it helpful to tell a little bit about Cam? I mean, a lot of people know about him, but a lot of people don't. I mean, pretty incredible American dream story, I guess. Like us, also an immigrant from Iran, came here when he was 18.
Let me pause.
Yeah.
Is it weird that immigrant families tend to, and everybody on Mars and space will be immigrants one day. What is it? And maybe we can come back to this after you give Cam's opinion or maybe during his introduction.
Yeah.
What is it about the immigrant mentality that drives innovation or drives like entrepreneurship?
Yeah. I think there's a frontier angle. Like, so my family left the USSR just broken apart, left what is now known as Ukraine. And as soon as they could get out, they left for a better opportunity. And it's because, you know, America is viewed as this place that has social mobility, is the most meritocratic of the country. Like you can go there and you can have a chance of improving your life. And so I think that kind of ties back, you know, America is probably the closest thing we have to a frontier today. And I think, there's nothing that, you know, lights a fire in your belly than coming over here. You know, in my parents' case, you know, they had a 3-year-old and they didn't speak any English, and like, you gotta make stuff happen. So I think, it's that type of work ethic is, and I think about it a lot cause now I'm a dad, and it's like the things that make me the way I am, my son will not be going through those.
Right.
And so, but it's a whole nother thing, but I think, there's definitely something to it. I think the stats are like half of unicorns have like a immigrant founder.
It's, there's like a chart that says like what your trajectory to becoming a unicorn founder is. And it's like a lot of it is like having some sort of hardship, whether that be immigration or whether that be, you know, whatever other hardship in your life builds the character to that, take on the hard problems. And being a founder is not easy.
Totally.
And so having some experience in your life with hardships, say, oh, this isn't too bad.
Yeah, totally. That perspective is helpful. Yeah, I think from what I've seen, there's a lot of like important qualities, but not giving up seems like the cardinal one. Like, because it's so hard. Like if you have something else you can do that's easier, if you're not totally resolute, convinced you have to do it, or you have some massive chip on the shoulder, you got to prove something to someone, like it's going to be really hard. And at some point you're just going to give up. And so I think that's all tied to it too. Yeah. I mean, like, so going to Cam's story, a classic, like amazing immigrant story, came here when he was 18, like $2,000 borrowed from his uncle, was valeting cars.
But where did he come from?
Iran. Yep. And started getting degrees. He's got like 5 degrees or so. CJ can fact check me. Got a bunch of aerospace degrees. He had this very seminal moment when he was a child seeing Neil Armstrong.
Nice.
Might have heard it on the radio. I don't want to date Cam.
I get 5 degrees a day. 5 Celsius a day.
Nice. And yeah, like of the current like space tycoons, and I put Cam in that bucket, he's the only one that actually made his money in space. And so he's worked in the industry for decades. He came up through the government contracting world, which I knew nothing about, but it turns out NASA and all the agencies, but he was focused on NASA specifically, bid out a lot of the work they do. You know, they have their internal workforce, but a lot of the stuff they do, whether it's the Mission Control Center, when astronauts say, you know, Houston, I have a problem, those were Cam's employees, are outsourced. And so Cam built up this business over a couple decades, and it's a very sharp-elbowed sector. Generally, if you win something, an incumbent lost it. And so it's
zero sum.
Yeah. But what's interesting is like it they do a lot of teaming and collaboration. Mm-hmm. It's zero sum, but like you gotta there's a lot of game theory basically involved. And so like Cam's skills have been sharpened over decades in terms of finding, you know, figuring out the contracts, how do you bid and propose them, how do you make a team. And so he built up this business and he sold it for $400 million in 2018. And, you know, really just kind of an incredible immigrant story. But as it relates to what I now work on is since 2009, he began incubating more startup type entities. And so one of them is Axiom Space, a space station company. One is a nuclear energy company called X Energy. And then he has a company called Quantum Space. And then Intuitive Machines, which landed on the moon in March, which was incredible. So I think
some countries haven't even been able to land on the moon, and a private company has done it. That's crazy to me.
Yeah, the portfolio of companies he's put together, and it's not like a VC fund. Like he has co-founded these companies, he's funded them, we're incredibly involved in them. He really is like a co-founder more than like an investor or board member.
Yeah, I've had a chance to sit with Cam and meet him, and he's an incredible person. Yeah. I'm really excited to continue working with you guys.
Yeah.
We have a couple cool announcements that we'll get to later, but.
Yeah, very excited about that. So to answer your question about how I see things developing, I think the space station market specifically is just, it's very clear that it's going to happen. Going back to like the blog post, there's not other startups selling to other startups. Like there's a space station today, it's 25 years old, this is the ISS, and it's going away.
Right.
And so there's a vacuum, and the vacuum represents an opportunity not just to replace what the ISS did, but augment it, because you're going from a government-owned asset to a commercial entity. Mm-hmm. And I know you've thought a lot about this as well, is like, what can a commercial space station do that the ISS can't?
Right.
There's no speculation involved with like, you know, is there value in a space station? Like
there's there's base value in all the space industry and the space station.
Yeah.
But there's augmented value if some things go right. Right. So if you assume launch costs come down dramatically, then you need more space on a space station. Maybe it's a way station. The first investment we ever did at Type One was Orbit Fab. This guy, crazy guy, Daniel Faber, love him. He came up to us and he goes, I'm building gas stations in space. And I was like, oh, I'm an Arab guy, gas stations, we get this. All right, here you go, let's do it. But the augmenting of where the space industry can go when humans get involved, it's not just about the downstream, the imaging and the stuff you can make in space. Yep. I think when humans get involved and that price comes down to a place where it's like as easy as flying on a commercial airliner, what are the companies that are going to succeed? And I think Axiom is very well positioned for that. And it'll be, like you said before, fear and greed, that distinction you made, I think when the shift happens, it'll be very fast. Because when a Starship can take you up at what Elon thinks they can do, what are the things that are unlocked? So I think you guys are very well positioned, and some of the early visionary companies that Cam has been involved in, I'm very excited to see unfold.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of people talk about humans shouldn't be in space.
Yeah.
right? Like humans should never go to space. Everything that we'll do in space is
Can I tell you a Peter Thiel story about this?
I'd love to hear it.
So I don't know about, do you look up to Peter Thiel? Like
I don't know him personally. I look up to a lot of the things he's done.
Yeah.
And I've read Zero to One.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
I don't know him personally. Like I have interacted, my story is about interacting with him, but just like his ideas, were they meaningful to you? Like,
yeah, they were meaningful to me. Like, you know, every investment has to return the fund, things like that. Yeah. But to look up to someone, I like to meet them and interact with them. Not just like, it's kind of like don't meet your heroes type moment. Like, what do you know about somebody as opposed to what have you heard or seen about somebody? But he's an incredible, obviously undeniable.
Yeah. And I mean more like his ideas have been in, like when Zero to One came out and I was still doing
literally
my startup. Have
literally shaped our industry.
Yeah. And we were in a, Cam and I were at an event earlier this year and he showed up. It was a dinner, kind of like barbecue and so we went over there and we started, you know, telling him about the companies. It was just, he was exactly how I pictured he would be.
Really?
We started telling him about Axiom Space and he goes, how is this a monopoly? I only invest in monopolies. I was like, wow, that's how I always, you know, that's just exactly how I pictured you would talk.
Nice.
And like, I had thought about it before because I had read his books and like, I was like, Cam, I got this. Like, we have a monopoly on humans doing stuff in space. That's our silo. Whether it's in orbit or on the moon, eventually on Mars, the systems that are required to keep humans alive and what they want to do there—that's our monopoly. And he pauses and he accepted that answer, but then he goes, "We don't need. I don't think we need humans in space. Like, robots are fine."
Why do you think people say that? What drives that line of thinking?
I think it depends on what I think for him specifically, like, because I challenged him and I said, well, Elon is doing SpaceX because he wants to put humans on Mars. And he goes, well, that's fine. And I'm paraphrasing. Sorry, Peter. I'm sure you won't listen to this.
If you're listening to this,
send in a correction.
Invest in Axiom Space.
He might, but he was like, you know, basically some version of like Starlink is the like moneymaker. Like Elon might believe that. And he was saying that part doesn't really matter. Like the investment is because of Starlink. And so I think people see where it is money being made in space and the money is made with satellites taking pictures. They're sending communications. So it's kind of
today.
So I think it's just kind of a, I don't know if it's utilitarian or just kind of just like an analytical way of seeing where's value generated in space.
Well, I think it's like there's a lot of givens. Like this is where we stand today. And for people to make an investment or an assumption with a lot of other assumptions that still haven't played out. Even though you may believe those assumptions will play out, cost of launch coming down, Starship having daily flights, all those things. And when we invested in Gravitix, it was like the thesis was find a space station manufacturer that literally uses Starship as their whole business plan.
Yep.
And a lot of the pushback they got from other investors was, oh, well, is Starship going to work? And then you turn around and ask them, are you investing in SpaceX? And they say yes, but then they don't believe Starship's going to work.
Yeah.
And so I think there's this part of the thinking where until those things play out, like no kidding, it's working.
Yeah.
It's hard to make those level two or layer three with all these other assumptions.
Yeah.
So yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Well, I think, and I mean, the thing that comes up, I don't know about you, but like I've been in a lot of meetings with startups thinking through their fundraising strategy and everyone wants to replicate what SpaceX has done or what Anduril has done in defense. And, you know, they get, we were talking about this earlier, 20x revenue, you know, multiple, or Anduril I heard was 25x. I think there's another dynamic here, which is people, one, like SpaceX keeps increasing in value, so that helps them. But there's this flight to quality where if you get past the point where you're like, I want space exposure, then you just want to pick the best thing and then move on and stop thinking about it. And so I think like, and that's where, then when you like start poking SpaceX investors, like, do you believe in this and this? Like it doesn't, it's not, it was irrelevant to their underwriting. It was just like, I want space exposure. This thing keeps going up. I believe in Elon.
My friend told me I'm making 30, 40% a year on this.
Yeah.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. not to turn the tables, are you a buyer of SpaceX at $200 billion?
I'm a buyer of SpaceX at least until half a trillion.
Yeah.
I think SpaceX is a multiple trillion-dollar company long term.
Yeah.
My view of investing is take a 100-year view, break it down into 10-year increments, and the 100-year view informs your short-term view.
Yeah.
And so we believe SpaceX will be a multi-trillion-dollar company because of all the fundamentals.
Yep.
And then with that market map, like, we're investors in OpenAI, and so we look at OpenAI as like a leader of a sector.
Yep.
What are the other things in the ecosystem that we need to that they need to make that vision a success.
Yep.
If the market believes with billions of dollars a year, SpaceX is going to succeed and be that outcome, what are the derivative investments that we can make to win on that trajectory? Totally. That are higher alpha investments, higher risk, but higher reward as well. I'll keep investing in SpaceX. I think it's one of the best companies of our generation in terms of what they've achieved and what they're positioned to achieve. Like hell, going to Mars.
Yeah. Well, and Starship alone is just so crazy. I don't know if you read When the Heavens Went on Sale, the Ashley Vance book.
I saw it in person, and even photos don't do it justice.
Yeah. Well, so this his book, he kind of like spent a bunch of time embedded in Planet, Firefly, Astra, and Rocket Lab, and they just made an HBO documentary. And this was my like way to finally get my wife to like learn what I'm working on all the time is like this documentary, and she really enjoyed it. But they document beautifully like how hard it was for Astra and Rocket Lab, and building a rocket's really hard. But then you know you look at that and I think the capacity of Rocket Lab's like a couple hundred pounds. Mm-hmm. And Starship is 100,000 pounds.
It's insane.
Like that was really hard. Like people don't understand how incredible Starship is and mm-hmm. how big of a deal it is.
But people also don't understand the infrastructure you have to build that.
Yeah.
Rapid iteration, the changes on each little. They get the data from each flight and then they iterate in less than a month.
Yeah.
Also, look at Boeing. There's astronauts stuck on the station.
Yep.
They got $5 billion in a contract. SpaceX got 2.4, I think it was.
Yep.
And SpaceX's Dragon has been flying years ahead of its time.
Yeah.
So I think what that shows is for all of SpaceX's success, there's a change happening to the government-led space industry to private-led space industry.
Yep.
And outsiders getting involved and saying, why are things done this way?
Yep.
Why are we engineering in this way?
Yep.
And that's what I'm really excited to see, where you're going to see innovations like SpaceX probably in the next decades with that same line of thinking.
Yep.
The cost plus model, where it's like, I need 100 components or 1,000 components for a spaceship. I'm going to subcontract all those components out, and then they're going to subcontract a bunch of other people, and margin is put on every part of that.
Yeah.
As opposed to let's build it as much of it in-house as possible and innovate where we can.
Yeah. And I think the thing that Cam has done a really good job of, and he's nailed part one of this playbook, and now we're on to part two, which is what SpaceX did as well, is leverage the government as a first customer, and the COTS contract that SpaceX won, like in the Elon biography, you know, he changed his password on his computer to "I love NASA." Mm-hmm. And the Axiom Cam's co-founder Mike Sefferdini was the one that, I don't know if he literally awarded it, but he was like involved with it. But either way, that contract, using the government to help you stand up your business and then build this flourishing commercial.
Well, I think NASA itself should be like a regulator of the space industry, right? It should understand where it makes sense for investors to play and where it doesn't make sense for investors to play, allocate dollars. And I'm seeing that shift, allocate dollars to stand up those industries, subsidize those industries until they're self-sustaining, and then private investors can fill the gap.
Yep.
And so that's a great example.
And they've done a really good job with the CLPS program, is the lunar lander program that, you know, IM used to land something to the moon. I forgot the specific number.
One of our companies is on IM too. We're excited to see them land on the moon.
That's right. Lunar Outpost. Yeah. You know, they... Again, CJ can fact check me here. I think it's $140 million is how much IM, Intuitive Machines, spent to land something on the moon. And they did this kind of like survival of the fittest, where like they gave out contracts to a number of companies so far. I am the only one that's succeeded. But if they tried to do that program themselves, or if they tried to land a payload themselves, it would have spent billions of dollars.
You know, I met Dan Golden. He was former NASA administrator under Clinton and Bush and HW as well.
Yep.
And he was telling me how NASA's budget was increasing year over year.
Yep.
And there was more people, but they were doing less with those people.
Yeah.
He decided to cut NASA staff by 25%. And he ended up doing more with less money.
Yeah.
And when companies become too big in every sector, there tends to be a lot more bureaucracy.
Yeah.
And that's where the startup world really succeeds, where it's like, solve a problem.
Yeah.
And that's why you have like, you know, even Google. Why didn't Google build their own AI? Or why didn't Microsoft build their own AI? You need that nimbleness in the private markets. And I think we're seeing that even in space right now. And that's where people will ask me like, oh, why doesn't SpaceX just do it?
Yeah.
They're focused on a whole different set of problems. You need startups in the ecosystem to succeed and work on other problems. So
that human thing, I just think is super interesting. I know you fly internationally a lot. I was at the tail end of like a 12-hour flight. So I was feeling a little loopy and I was like, what do I want to teach my son? And one of the things I landed on, which is just to me so non-intuitive, is that the more people involved, the worse it works. Like, that's just surprising.
Isn't that weird?
You would think that like 10,000 people would have an easier job doing something than 100, but no, it just turns out like communicating, coordinating is really hard. And it's
understanding what everyone's doing. In the early days of Type 1, we were like 5 or 6, and I knew what everyone was doing at every single moment. I knew I didn't have to have meetings to get updates with everyone. When you get a big organization, you have 10 or 20 or whatever amount of departments or people running parallel.
Yeah.
And that flow of information isn't as concise.
Yeah.
And then everyone has different relationships. So you're a big organism as opposed to just like a nimble organism.
Yeah,
you know?
For sure.
What's your favorite sci-fi book?
There's so many good options. I think The Three-Body Problem had the most interesting ideas. I don't know if you read that one, that they just turned it into
I saw
a show.
The Netflix. I didn't see the Netflix documentary, but I saw it was turned into one.
Yeah, yeah. It just has like some really cool concepts in it. Like I also love Andy Weir. Like I think, you know, The Martian is amazing.
Yeah.
And Hail Mary is really good.
I have both of those books.
Ender's Game, we talked about. That was like, I think the first space, like sci-fi book I read when I was a kid. Those are all like just great.
My favorite one, if you haven't read it, is a 4-book series. He's coming out with the 5th one.
Yeah.
It's called We Are Legion, We Are Bob by Dennis Taylor.
I haven't heard of that one.
This guy, and it's so like interesting because this guy was a founder in 2012.
Yeah.
He sold his company and then he decided to take some of his money and buy a, like what Walt Disney did where he freezes his, if he dies, his body so he can come back to life later.
Yeah.
He goes to Vegas on a conference, gets hit by a car in 2012. Last thing he remembers is him being frozen in his like pod. And then 100 years go by and then the world's at war and you have like a technologist faction and then you have a no technology faction and they're at war. Mm-hmm. And so he gets uploaded. His mind gets uploaded to a computer.
Yeah.
Not his body. And he can't see anything. He can't see his body. But he realizes he's a satellite. And they're sending him as a von Neumann probe to explore the cosmos. And he makes a copy of himself every time he gets to a new place.
Yeah.
So he started off as Bob. And then the next guy's Bill. And then the next guy's whatever. And so then there's like hundreds of Bobs out in the universe, like colonizing different star systems and terraforming planets. And it was really cool to see. What was super interesting about that book was each copy of each individual was different. It wasn't like Anton 1... Anton 2, you're the same people.
Yeah.
Every time you screenshot a photo, it gets pixelated a little bit.
Mm,
and the same idea was in like copying his consciousness.
Yeah, lose a little bit of...
That was a great sci-fi book.
So. That's cool. The other one I forgot about is Seven Eves. It's either... I always mix up the Neils. It's by a guy named... First name's Neil. Really cool premise. The moon explodes. No one knows why. Into 7 pieces. And then they figure out the pieces are going to start crashing into each other and make lots of rubble. And in like a year or two, all the rubble is going to come and destroy everything.
Mm.
And so the first half of the book is society figuring out what to do. Like at the beginning, there's like 8 people on the ISS. And it's like, how many people can we get up there? and this, you know, the Russians figure out a way to just do these like inflatable like hamster wheels that cost like, you know, $100, like,
no way,
like basically like expandable space stations. And then halfway through the book, it speeds up 10,000 years and it shows like what that society turned into. Just like incredible that there are humans that can,
in that book as well, they had like a I don't know if it was that book or The Children of Time, that's another sci-fi book, where it was like a whole generation of people was like on a spaceship, and then kids were being born on a spaceship and they didn't have any like recollection of what it was like to live on a planet, and like their whole life was a spaceship. Yeah,
totally.
And so it's cool to see like what those parallel sci-fi universes could be, because in the future for humanity, that may be our future, you know?
Totally.
Do you think there's going to be multiple space stations?
Inevitably, yeah. It's all just a factor of what timeline, you know, things develop. But the ISS is scheduled to go away in 2030. Could be a lot sooner. I think in the 2030s, I would be very surprised if there's not multiple space stations operating in the 2030s and hundreds, if not thousands, of people living in space.
Yeah.
That would be, it'd be disappointing if that was the case.
I agree with you. I mean, for us, we're really excited. I mean, I think when we decided to lead Axiom Series D, we believed in that thesis.
Yeah.
And now your partnership with Gravitix, which was an investment we made.
Yeah.
Ultimately believe in an Axiom's thesis of like, you need to privatize the manufacturing, you need to bring it into America, American dynamism as well. But I do believe there's going to be hundreds of people in space on space stations. There's no reason that humans shouldn't be.
Yep.
The humans are the super application for space. And it's a lot harder to 500 years ago for people to get on a boat with no GPS, no navigation, look at the stars and take a boat into a land that has no resources.
Yeah.
We have so much technology nowadays where going to space is easy. You go on a Falcon 9, you press a button.
Yeah.
You don't have to, you can be the pilot.
Yeah.
You don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited to get involved with Axiom. I think it'll be one of the most successful companies of our generation in the space industry. So I'm excited to announce more about that.
Yeah, we're very excited. I'm very excited that we're partnering on this together.
Cool. Well, Anton, I appreciate you being here. Do you have any other last thoughts, comments, questions?
No, I enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for having me.
Cool, man. Thanks.
Thank you.